Okay, we'll call the second meeting of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee together. Welcome, everybody.
You're doing a good job.
And we have some good work for us to do today. So we're going to hear our first bill, House Bill 83. But first, before we do that, I would ask for the a motion for approval of the minutes.
So moved.
Representative Isaacson has read the minutes carefully and would move that we approve them. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Our first bill, Representative Freiberg is here and will present us with House File 83. Welcome to the committee. And I believe that Representative Bly has a motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 83 so that it might be considered recommended to pass and be laid over for future consideration.
It's the motion before us.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd like to describe your bill. And
sure, thank you.
I know you have witnesses.
I have to keep using this excuse while I can, but this is the first time I've ever presented a bill, so bear with me if I say anything off, or just feel free to correct me. I won't take it personally. And thank you, Representative Clark. Thank you, Representative Bly, for the motion. I got interested in this topic largely because of a constituent of mine. Her name is Rose McGee. She lives a few blocks away from me. Her house, she has a beautiful house in Golden Valley, and she's lived there for over 20 years, always made payments on time, but it wasn't until she had some difficult life circumstances intervene that she fell behind on her payments. She was under the impression that she was working, the mortgage company was working with her to address this, and then refinance her loan so she could keep the house she's lived in for so long. But while this was going on, and she was working with somebody else at the company, began foreclosure proceedings basically without informing her. This procedure is known as dual tracking. Basically, one person at a company is ostensibly working with you to refinance your loan, while somebody else is undercutting it and beginning foreclosure proceedings. So the primary thing that this bill would do is prohibit the practice of dual tracking. Rose was going to be here. She was here at a press conference we just had, but the good news is she has a new job, and it requires her to be to fly to Nebraska on this, so she's probably on a plane right now going down there, so it was nice of her to be here just before, and I understand we may have a video of her, too. So I won't talk about her situation anymore. I'll let her do that by video, but just to walk through the bill with you, there are several provisions in here. It's modeled after the California Homeowners Bill of Rights. I think these are pretty common sense provisions. The section one here requires some additional notices to be provided to people who are military service members. Military service members often have additional stresses in their lives, and there is a higher rate of housing problems with them as a result of that. Sections 2 and 3 basically require a mortgage company to have a single point of contact that the homeowner can work with if they are working to renegotiate a loan. I'm sure we've all been part of a phone tree when you're calling a big company. You never know who the right person to talk to is. They say one person says you need to talk to somebody else. That person says you need to talk to the first person. So this would just require a single person who's familiar with the homeowner's situation and who has some decision-making authority to be the point of contact for that person. Section 4 is the provision dealing with dual tracking. Basically, once a renegotiation is going on, then there's a 60-day window where foreclosure proceedings can't commence. And Section 5 would require mandatory mediation just so that the process can be less adversarial and a neutral third party can be involved. So that's just my summary of the bill. I don't know how you'd like to proceed, if we should proceed, if there are any questions, or if we should just proceed with the video at this point.
Okay, I guess we could see if there's any immediate questions for the author. We are going to have some testimony, and you'll have a chance to ask questions after that. If that's okay, we'll maybe go ahead with the proponents. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just by way of background, could you give us some idea, Representative, as to how long this bill has been in the works, and did you get any input from the banking community, or how did you proceed to come up with this bill?
Sure. We modeled it after the California Homeowners Bill of Rights, which is a law that was adopted last year. So we worked with House Research, took some provisions from that. You know, I have been contacted. You know, we kind of wanted to get moving on this. I know Representative Clark took an interest in this topic, and I did too, partly because the proceedings are still ongoing with Ms. McGee, so we wanted to get this out there quickly. You know, I've said I am interested in learning the positions of, you know, the concern. What if the banking industry does have any concerns? What those are, and seeing if they can be addressed in a way that's satisfactory.
And Representative Anderson, we'll have a chance to hear from them today. So, okay, why don't you go ahead with your witnesses? The first is a videotape from Ms. McGee, and I believe one of our I think Will can probably figure out how to turn that on. This is Rose McGee. I believe she introduces herself.
Very much. I appreciate what the legislators are doing. This is very important. I want to just start out by saying one of my favorite poets said, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun?" And then the last line of it is, "Does it explode?" And I think in my case, explosion came when I realized that having lived in my home for almost 20 years and it's now being taken away from me, sometimes we don't know where that energy comes from that says you're going to fight. This is not how I was planning to spend my time at this age. I think about my neighborhood, I think about my neighbors, and I think about the fact that we've had so many wonderful experiences at my home. We've shared it to so many people. But to suddenly find out that because of a job layoff about a year ago, I can't keep up with the payments. I immediately notified City Mortgage to let them know that I wouldn't be able to, but I believed that I was going to get employment again, which I was. And even with that, now they were saying to me, okay, let's take a look at what modification can look like for you. And just disregard any writings or letters or phone calls that you may receive from us, because that's just part of robocalls. So I'm listening to that and I'm believing that. So the original sheriff's sale was moved out, and I'm thinking that we're really working here, only to learn one day when I called and said, "What's the status?" Well, guess what? Your house has been sold. Well, that's pretty devastating. I thought maybe, you're kidding, right? You don't really mean that. But they did mean that. So since then, it's just been calls after calls, fight after fight. There have been several organizations that have worked with me, and I've got, you know, the law firm now of Jews that's working with me. And to have NCRC and Jewish Community Action, Occupy, all of them coming together and saying, you know, let's fight with you. What I've discovered is people don't know where to go to fight. They don't know how to fight. But what I've also discovered is there shouldn't have to be a doggone fight. Not like it's been for this many months. Right. If you've paid your mortgage this many years, why the heck is it that you should suddenly be kicked out? There hasn't been any kind of form of legal mediation that has taken place up front. Why not? Why is it that the only time that I've had any kind of due process has been tracking should not be? Dual tracking meaning, on one hand, it seems like the bank is working with you, and then right out from under you, they've sold the doggone house. And when I learned what this meant, because first of all, I never heard of the term, and now it's like, okay, and not only that, but they kind of kicked the price up even more. And the what they're now, it's just ridiculous, is all I can say. But it shouldn't have to be, and I want to see this particular bill pass so that people who don't even know yet that they're going to have to deal with something like this won't have to deal with something like this. And people who are poor, people who are renters, people who are being kicked out into the streets because the dwelling that they're in, current language does. So it's not just my fight. This is a fight for people who aren't here. This is a fight for people of all classes. And not only that, I hope that people recognize is it's not just a particular party. This is not just about the Republicans. It's not just about the Democrats or just about the Green Party. This is something that is about humanity. Thank you.
Okay. So as those of you who are here, I guess a couple of people walked in. That was Ms. Rose McGee speaking to us by previous videotape, made just an hour ago or so, I guess, because she had to get on a plane to go to her job. So thank you for that. And I think you want, if you would like to next call your next witness, and the person I have down here is
Rabbi Latz.
Rabbi Michael Latz. Welcome to the committee. Rabbi Latz, have you just introduced yourself, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've long admired your courageous leadership, and it's an honor to be with you. I'm Michael Latz. I am the senior rabbi at Shir Tikvah of Minneapolis. Thank you, committee members, for having me here with you, and good luck this session.
Yeah.
I'm honored to offer testimony in support of this Homeowners Bill of Rights and in support of my friend and a beautiful treasure of our community, Rose McGee. It's a joy to call Rose my friend and work with her on this sacred project alongside our partners, the Jewish Community Action and the Northside Community Reinvestment Coalition. I'd like to begin by quoting the great Elie Wiesel, called by many the conscience of the world, who proclaimed that there may be times when we are powerless to prevent injustice, but there must never be a time when we fail to protest. This is our protest. Madam Chair and members of the committee, as a religious leader, a child of Minnesota, a homeowner, a taxpayer, a man of deep faith, the grandson of a union organizer and the great-grandson of immigrants, and the cousin to the great senator from St. Louis Park, Ron Latz, I know the value of good neighborhoods, safe homes, and our Minnesota way of life. I'm a product of it. What has happened to Rose McGee and the bank's practice of dual tracking and the lack of mediation is a stain on the reputation of Minnesota. If it only happened to Rose Dayenu, that would have been tragic. She's a beloved member of our community, a courageous leader, and she's followed the rules. All she asked was that the system would be fair, that the person and the bank she was working with would deal with her honorably. If it only happened to Rose, it would be a singular tragedy. But today, Madam Chair, Minnesota's frozen is a frozen garden full of roses who have suffered the injustice, the unfairness, the humiliation from the immoral conduct of this dual tracking practice. People are suffering. Good people like Rose are suffering needlessly. There are people in my congregation and in communities across Minnesota, people in Starbuck and Fauston and Virginia and Buffalo. Ironically, this shameful and deceptive practice has been an equal opportunity predator, probably the best example of bipartisanship in the state, affecting Minnesotans of every race and faith and neighborhood, religious community, sexual orientation, and political affiliation. Our protest is not for a hand out or a hand up. It's a protest born of people who have spent the last several thousand years standing up to tyrants and pharaohs whose depraved indifference to human suffering was their ultimate downfall. Our protest is to demand that those of our friends and our neighbors, our congregants and family members who work hard and play by the rules, don't have the rules changed along the way so the banks are favored at the expense of our homes and our communities, because this is not what democracy looks like. Treating every citizen with respect, with dignity and compassion, that's the democracy we know and love. There are thousands, about 150,000 stories like Rose in the state of Minnesota. To solve this grave injustice will require your courageous moral leadership. There are many times, too many times, when Elie Wiesel is right, when we are powerless to stop injustice, to stop unnecessary suffering and anguish. So many times when our small lives move from one crass and different platitude to another, when we cannot or choose not to do anything, when we live from one craven failure of cynicism and despair to another. But you, the great leaders sitting in this room today, you Republicans and Democrats, good people of faith, have been elected to rest your heads on the hard pillow of leadership each night. You have the power in your hands and your vote to end the unnecessary suffering of people like Rose and those in my congregation and in congregations throughout the state and your constituents and neighbors and family, those standing today in the halls and the rotunda of this great cathedral of democracy. You have the power to stop unnecessary suffering, to liberate our neighbors from the shackles of the foreclosure crisis, the uncertainty, and the desperation of financial ruin. You can end this immoral and outrageous behavior of dual tracking by proclaiming it what it is, an illegal, depraved, toxic scam destroying the soul of the Minnesota we love. You can deliver them and us with this legislation and put us, all the great people of this state, on a path once again toward prosperity and secure neighborhoods with stable homeowners who together build our communities and our shared future. Your citizens are crying out to you for a courageous response. Rose is calling, and people of faith in every neighborhood, on every street, of every political persuasion, beseech you to act. The time for courageous leadership is now. This is our protest. Thank you.
Thank you, Elena. Okay. Any questions from committee members for Rabbi Letts? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Our next witness, then, I believe your next witness was going to be Sharonda Orge, but I believe she's ill, and she's being replaced by Kaylin Crawford. Ms. Crawford, welcome to the committee, and if you'll just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. My name is Kaylin Crawford. I'm a homeowner in Frogtown and an organizer and homeowner with Occupy Homes Minnesota. It was about 2 years ago now. I was injured in a snowboarding accident and was unable to pay my mortgage for about 3 months. I knew I was going to be out of work for those 3 months. I called the bank before I was late on any payments, and they told me the only way we can help you is if you're in default. So if you stop paying your mortgage, then we'll modify your loan for you. And so I did, because why would the bank lie to me? That's what I did. Immediately they started the foreclosure proceedings. I went into foreclosure, and whenever I tried to talk to them about what can I do to get out of foreclosure, their response was, oh yeah, you need to talk to so-and-so. And U.S. Bank's response was, oh, you need to talk to Freddie Mac. And Freddie Mac's response was, you need to talk to U.S. Bank. I was jostled around. It was over more than a full-time job to try and just even communicate the basic information with the bank. In October of 2011, they finally sent me a letter saying, all right, you're in review for a modification, so we won't sell your house or at a sheriff's sale for 30 days, and 7 days later they did. At that point, they kept kind of similar to Rose, they kept telling me, oh yeah, just don't worry about that. We've got things taken care of on our end. I was told we can't help you until after the redemption period. I was told so many different things. And I got an eviction letter in July, a summons to eviction court. At that point, I realized that they were serious about kicking me out of my house and went and got an attorney. And the only reason I'm still in my home now is I had the resources. I had English as my first language. I had the time. I had family members that were willing to put up their time to work full-time to keep me in my home. And I had the resources to go find an attorney, and we ended up filing a lawsuit against Freddie Mac and U.S. Bank. Even the lawsuit citing wrongful foreclosure didn't open up the dialogue with them. They still wouldn't have any contact with me or with my attorney because it was past the redemption period, so they didn't want to talk about it. I joined forces with Occupy Homes Minnesota to make sure that this would never happen to anybody else. I consider myself pretty well educated and never figured that I would be the one in this situation. And I wanted to make sure that everybody else that this was happening to was brought, you know, that j- justice was served and that they would never, that nobody else would have to go through this, the same thing that I did. I launched my campaign. I had about 56 or 57 community members and neighbors and homeowners and organizers from Occupy show up at my house for my Beat the Banks barbecue. And we took a picture in front of my house pledging that I was not going to leave, and that was my home. And this nameless or this faceless organization didn't have any right to come in and kick me out of my home without even talking to me, especially after I had done so much work to stay in my home. And 4 days after that, I got a settlement offer from Freddie Mac. It shouldn't have taken 56 people standing on my lawn, hours and hours of canvassing my neighborhood to get my community to stand behind me to bring Freddie Mac to the table. Especially, you know, I've been a taxpayer since I was 15, so I am now, despite the settlement offer, we're still in settlement negotiations, so it's been 4 months now that we've been in negotiations. I still have a foreclosure on my record. I'm 24 years old. I have a foreclosure on my record. That's 2 years of stress and anguish that has affected my family, my health, my mom's health. Her doctor at one point told her to give up. He said, you need to stop this fight because it's really, really hurting you. And like I said, I was fortunate enough to have the resources and the time and the energy to put into this. I also, when they foreclosed on my loan, I only owed $28,000 on my house. So they've put over and above that into defending their foreclosure that they admitted that they shouldn't have done in the first place. If they would have told me from the beginning, there's nothing that we can do to help you right now, you just got to keep making your payments, I could have kept making my payments. I would have found a way to do it. But I listened to them, and it's just recently that I've been able to get over this, the negative stigma attached in our society about talking about financial issues. This foreclosure was not my fault. I did what the bank told me to do. And they're making money on kicking me out of my home. I live in the most foreclosed district in Minnesota. And there's a house across the street from me that's vacant. There's a house next door to me that's vacant. And there's one two doors down that just got bulldozed. My street and my neighborhood don't need any more vacant homes. And I was there willing and able to pay to stay in my home. And they were the only barrier that was keeping me from staying in my home. So I'm excited that this bill is in front of you, and excited that you guys now have the opportunity to stand up for the citizens of Minnesota and stand up for our communities that are being ravaged by these banks and hold them accountable and start rebuilding where the banks left off.
Thank you, Ms. Crawford. Okay. I believe there's a question. Representative Isaacson.
Madam Chair, in your communications with the bank, when you were being told to wait till the foreclosure happened, or there was times they were telling you to wait, were you in communications with the same person at the bank, or were these different people at different times instructing you on how to proceed with your foreclosure?
It was usually different people. The banks, it's really interesting for me to compare my bank or my record of all the conversations with their records of their conversations with me. At one point, I had asked them to send me my file, and they sent me Mary Smith's from Massachusetts, entire mortgage file. Not really sure where mine ended up in that, but during the whole time talking with them, I really felt like the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to people who had no investment in the outcome, and I did have one pretty good contact at Freddie Mac that I was in contact with for about 2 weeks, and he was the most static one that I ever had. And then he ran out of ideas. Essentially, mm-hmm. He ran out of ideas, and I was passed around. That was back when U.S. Bank employees were allowed to email. And so I have email records of the people that I had been in contact with, but the I would get two or three emails back and forth, and then they would pass me on to somebody else.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Hertas.
Yes. Do you recall, with regard to the mortgage documents and the mortgage, the mortgage covenants that you signed when you took out the mortgage, were you covered by a mortgage foreclosure by advertisement or foreclosure by service or action?
Ms. Garfin?
I'm not sure.
Another question, Representative Hertas? No? Okay.
Excuse me?
Did you complete your questions?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thanks for sharing your story. And just a clarification for my benefit. You mentioned, I think if I heard correctly, that you were injured and for 3 months you couldn't make your payments. Is that correct?
Yes.
And after that point, that's where I'm confused. The bank said to stop making payments at that point, or could you have resumed making payments after that three-month period? That's where I'm confused here.
They started the foreclosure process right away, and after they start the foreclosure process, they wouldn't take payments from me. So when I would contact them, they'd say the only payment we're going to take right now is if you pay to become current on your loan, which they would never give me the amount. I have two letters from them in June when I was able to start paying, and one of them says that I owe $2,900 to become current. The same exact letter with the same exact date I have that says it's going to be $5,000 to be current.
Ms. Anderson?
Thanks, Ian. Just to follow up, Madam Chair. So did you try to get that number ironed out so you could make make good?
Ms. Crawford? Yeah. One more question. Any other questions? Representative
Madam
Isaacson?
Chair, just to follow up, are you saying that immediately after you had called them to let them know that you've been injured, it was right after that the foreclosure began?
Yes.
So you hadn't been delinquent on anything up to that point?
Right.
Ms. Crawford?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. The next person I have is Ann Haynes from St. Paul. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Haynes.
Thank you.
Just state your name, please.
It's Ann Haynes, and I'm a homeowner in the Hamline University area, also in foreclosure. I, too, like Kaylin, wanted to seek out a modification to get the payments on my home reduced and was also informed that I needed to default in order for that to happen. To that point, I was current. I've lived in my home. It will be 13 years next month. After that, they told me in the pre-foreclosure process that I needed to contact a counselor or seek out help in Ramsey County. I did do that. I met with a woman one time who started the process of sending in an application. That was one of the last contact I had with her. She had disappeared. The bank continued to contact me requesting the application for modification. This would have been a year ago. I sent that in. It was due on the February 19th. They sold my home on the 23rd of February. They did not stop the process of the application, which I was informed that they needed to do so. From February to June, no contact. June, I received a letter from U.S. Bank with the woman's name who was supposed to be my point of contact, who I would talk to. In that letter, it appeared that the process was still taking place and if I had any questions to contact this person. In August, I called to follow up. I could not reach her by phone, and she had said that the paperwork was not received in time for them to review it. They needed 14 days prior to that day to review it. I clearly have the documentation of the day it was required. I have a fax confirmation that they received the information. At that point, I started seeking out people, anyone, neighbors, friends, anyone that knew anyone, and I was met up with Martha, who was the first person that had listened to my story from finish to end. Since then, I'm working with legal aid. They asked me to leave the lawyers in the case wanted me out of the house by December 20th of this past year. The attorney got that date pushed back. Freddie Mac sent letters stating they were the new homeowners, and I had two options. I could either get cash for the keys in the amount of $3,000 or rent my home on a month-to-month basis. Not knowing what to do, no resources at all, I chose to stay there. That's the home that I provided for my three children. And I was pretty much forced to sign a lease to stay there. REMAX came in. They changed the locks on my home. They made changes in the home. They anchored my stove to the house. There's a chain on my, I don't know they what that meant. I came home one day after work just to quickly run in and get something for my son to take his gym shoes to the gym, and there was an intruder in my home who later stated he worked for REMAX and he was there to do an inspection. I was then the lease was terminated due to, they said I was not supplying them the home for them to show it. In the lease, it clearly stated they had to give me 72 hours to do that. They were not doing that. They were calling me at work saying they needed it available. There is still a lockbox on my front door, and now I'm working with legal aid to try to rectify this. In the day before Thanksgiving, so like the 21st of November, we actually got in touch with the woman at U.S. Bank who was the point of contact, who admitted they sent me the wrong modification paperwork. And so it was thrown out to the side. I don't know what happened to it. But they admitted fault in this proceeding. And now I'm just working with my attorney to see if they will reverse the foreclosure. Where we stand right now, I do not know. We had court last Wednesday, and they canceled it. They, meaning U.S., not even U.S. Bank, I think it's Freddie Mac.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Representative Isakson.
You had stated that after you had signed a lease, that REMAX was then modifying, changing locks, all those things, even though you had a signed lease to live there, and that they claim in the lease, or there is a provision in the lease that says they have to give you 72 hours notice, which they did not give you.
Right.
And then how did they notify you that the lease was terminated?
I paid the rent that they required for October, mm-hmm. With no receipt of any payment. In the November payment, I requested a receipt for October and a receipt for November. That payment for November was returned, my check was returned to me, and a receipt for October was also included. And there was no reason why they terminated the lease. They just said that they had the right to do so.
And that they just noticed. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you. There was a note in there saying that it was nobody called. It was a note.
Yes, it was delivered by mail.
And this was REMAX.
REMAX.
On behalf of Freddie Mac, or?
I believe so.
Ms. Haynes?
Thank you.
There was a property management involved as well, so I don't know how it all ties together.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At any time during the initiation of your attempt to remodify and notice of a sheriff's sale, were you ever in a position to bring your mortgage current, or did you have any resources to...
Just to continue payment. Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Let me just interrupt for a second. The reason I'm saying your names here back and forth is because this is all being taped for future people to look at in the future, and so it just makes it clear who's speaking. So okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's why I'm doing
okay.
That.
I could have continued the way I was for the last 12 years, but it was getting financially straining for me. I have three children, and I knew that there was a time that people could modify their home to bring that payment down, and that's solely why I looked to do that. But when I went to Ramsey County for help, that's what I thought I was doing, was at some point going to be told what the payments would be, when to start making them. It was just me looking for help that just it just kept continuing to door shut, dead end, and now I'm here today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hurtis.
So to give further clarity to your situation, you found yourself in a situation where you didn't have the resources to bring yourself current with a mortgage. You were hoping to, your understanding was you're hoping to remodify or restructure the existing debt that was on the home?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you say Ramsey County, do you mean the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency?
Ms. Haynes?
Do you know?
In the foreclosure, the pre-foreclosure paperwork that I was receiving from the attorneys for the bank said to contact a housing counselor, which it could very well be. It was Ramsey County. I don't know if it was Minnesota Housing, as you say it, but it was the number to call was a Ramsey County counseling for pre-foreclosures for help in understanding the process.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Representative Freiberg, do you know more substantive, because it makes a difference, and something I've been, if you could maybe find out, was that our state agency, Minnesota Housing Finance? And also, just one other quick question. As I'm hearing these three testimonies, all three are dealing with U.S. Bank. And Representative Freiberg, can you speak to the case before the Minnesota Attorney General dealing with U.S. Bank specifically?
Representative Freiberg.
I don't know the situation. Your first question, I guess I don't know the specifics exactly of your case. I know there is somebody from the Housing Finance Agency here. I don't know if that's something they'd be able to answer.
They might be able to. Representative Freiberg, I was just told that it's a City of St. Paul foreclosure counseling service, and we can find a little bit more about that. I don't know if there's anybody here from that service. No? Okay.
So I'm
that's
sorry.
The first question, and then the second one.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could you repeat the second question, too?
Representative O'Neill.
Yes. Representative Freiberg, are you aware that U.S. Bank is under investigation by the Minnesota Attorney General? And do you know about that case specifically? And could you speak to it, please?
I know about it. You know, I don't know exactly what the status is at this point. I mean, the provisions in this legislation aren't intended to go after any specific company. As I said at the outset, I mean, they seem pretty common sense to me. You know, the provision, I don't understand what sort of legitimate business justification there could be for a process like dual tracking. So I'm not trying to target any specific company here with this legislation. I'm just trying to, make a fair process for people. Because we've heard from the people here today. When I went door knocking around my district, I saw home after home that was vacant and foreclosed, with the sign up in the window. This is a problem statewide, I believe.
Is it on now?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Mariani. Oh, you weren't done? If you have another question, go right ahead.
I was just going to suggest that maybe when the bankers come, they could speak to that.
Correct. Good. Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair, just two things very quickly. One is I think we need to be very mindful that we don't legislate around litigation that's there. The whole purpose of our laws are to be applied objectively and fairly and uniformly. And so we're addressing broad public policy issues. And I certainly do not want, any clever lawyer to pull up any of our transcripts and say, well, see, this committee was targeting this particular, a defendant or plaintiff. And so I think we need to be very careful here and stick to the broad public policy issues that are before us. But we should probably seek, quite frankly, I'm not an attorney, but we should probably seek some good counsel from House counsel in regards to what are the proper parameters for discussion here relative to issues when we do have a situation where something is pending out of the courts. And then, Madam Chair, on another point, it might be helpful. I know this is only an informational hearing, but it might be helpful to have a presentation for this committee from the various constant services that exist. And obviously many of the folks who are undergoing the same circumstances that our testifier have undergone with, many of them have not had access to or haven't been serviced, but many have. And I think it might be helpful for us just to be fully informed of what some of the best practices and realities are out there in terms of dealing with these kind of issues. It might help us put into a little bit better perspective, where the best, public policy initiatives might be promoted by this legislature, even as you've got providers out there that are doing really good work within the existing public policy frame. So perhaps hearing from some of those, Madam Chair, at some point might be.
Thank you, Representative Marianne. It's a very good suggestion, and I'll ask my staff to help us bring in some counselors. I think there may be some in the audience today. We might have a little time for public testimony at the end here. We'll see. But we can definitely put that into our next hearing. Glad to do that. And other suggestions from committee members, I really appreciate it. Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Haynes? Thank you so much for your testimony. Oh, did you have a question? Excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Again, thank you, ma'am, for being here today. And you mentioned your mortgage, I think, was 12 years you took out your mortgage. And I assume at that time interest rates were quite a bit higher than they are today. Were you at all able to talk or attempt to get a lower mortgage rate? Would that have helped your situation to just simply modify your loan to get a lower interest rate?
At the time...
Go right ahead. Okay. No, you're okay.
I've lived in my home for 12 years. The mortgage was for 30 years. And I was just looking for any help to lower that payment cost. I don't know, I didn't know if I could do a refinance or a modification. I was just looking at any options to help decrease my monthly payment.
Representative Anderson?
Again, thanks, Madam Chair. What your lower interest rate would have done? What would lower your...
But at that time, I hadn't talked to anyone, so I didn't know if I was... I was looking for help to either modify it. I didn't know if that would bring the interest rate down or if it would just bring the payment down.
Okay. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we learned from some of the other testimony that at the inception of the mortgage, in the case of the video witness, that there was perhaps a married couple or a double income or two income type situation. Could you speak to that as to where you were 12 years ago? Did you start out initially with a double income in terms of qualifying? Or is that still the case today?
No,
so you found that your financial circumstances had changed during the 12 years?
Yes.
Okay, and so that was primarily the need for the modification.
And three growing children.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay, any further discussion? All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Haynes. The next person on our list is Mara Humphrey from the Minnesota Credit Union Network. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Humphrey. If you introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mara Humphrey, I'm the Vice President, Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network. We represent the state's 134 credit unions and their 1.5 million members. Appreciate the opportunity to provide a few comments today. Foreclosures are absolutely something that's very important that credit unions are looking at right now. We're very concerned about the number of foreclosures that have been going through, and looking forward to if there are opportunities to work with this committee or committee members on ways to address it. I did want to just raise a couple of concerns that I've heard about this bill. We haven't had a lot of time to take a look at it, but at our initial first glance, we did have a couple of initial concerns that I wanted to share with you. As people-centered, community-based financial institutions, we have a personal relationship with our members, and we really enter into a lifetime relationship with our members. So when we do make a mortgage, we want to make sure that our member succeeds with that mortgage, because we also want to have their savings account, their checking account, their other accounts with us as well. So really look at it as a lifetime relationship. We're not putting them into bad mortgages. Unfortunately, we have had some foreclosures recently due not to bad products that we've given out, but due to the economic downturn, people losing their jobs, and unfortunately there are situations where we do need to foreclose. And you know, in those cases, one makes sure that we are able to recover the assets. You know, credit unions as member-based organizations, we want to make sure that, you know, obviously we can help every member succeed, but if we're spending a lot of money or we're losing money on a foreclosure for the 1%, then the other 99% of the members end up paying for that. So looking at this legislation, concerned in some ways that this is really targeting the worst actors, you know, painting all lenders with the same brush. We don't have a ton of foreclosures, but if a credit union does have a foreclosure, this is a big deal and a big hit on their asset levels. So unfortunately, in that case, we do need the ability to recover it. I know legislation in other states has really looked at when they've gone into place similar to this, only targeting the really big national banks where this has been an issue. I know if you call up your credit union, they'll be more than happy to talk to you. And really what they aim to do is get people into foreclosure counseling, foreclosure prevention. They look to target members who may be struggling before they miss a payment. If they are looking like they may miss a payment, they want to make sure that they can get them in, work on the debt consolidation, work and see if there's a way to refinance them out of it before we get into what's considered a dual tracking situation. I just want to share a quick anecdote I heard from one of our credit unions. I was asking about, you know, one hand not talking to another, and this is one of my larger credit unions, and he commented that, yes, they do have someone different who does, you know, really look at the loan payments and the refinancing versus those who are going after the collections piece. But their two cubicles are next to each other, so I'm guessing they will obviously be talking to each other if something's going on. So look forward to working with the committee on legislation if there are ways that we can address foreclosures, but did want to just raise some of our initial concerns that this is going after everyone. And, you know, I don't think that you're going to see these practices in some of our smaller community-based credit unions. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Humphrey? Representative Hortas.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the benefit of the committee members, could you maybe speak to the criteria of the different products available in the home mortgage industry, particularly the fact that you have conforming loans and non-conforming loans available as options for consumers, and that when somebody is packaged under a conforming loan, that you have a little bit different set of rules and federal and state banking regulations which require you to treat people equally, and that includes the foreclosure process, and what that means in terms of having a troubled asset on your books, and that regulators come in and direct you to deal with non-performing assets. Because the important thing to understand here is that what we're talking about, even with large banks, it's not necessarily the big mean evil corporation, but they're required by federal law to protect the assets of those mortgage-backed securities, and that money belongs to the teachers' union, the pension plans, your private savings, of the people who live next door. So could you maybe just speak to some of those issues?
Something.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, I think we have seen the regulators carefully watching how we do refinances, how we repackage them. I think credit unions are really, it's been a tough balance between what the regulators are allowing, because obviously the National Credit Union Administration walks in and they want to make sure that credit unions are being safe and sound. So they're going to take a very close look at what we're doing. But I think within our ability, credit unions have really been working to do what they can. I mean, if there's an option that someone can continue to make payments and they can work with them, they're definitely very open to doing that. But it is a fine balance. I mean, obviously we want to make sure that our financial institutions remain safe, sound, and secure, and that is what regulators are definitely looking for.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had a question, somebody. You indicated that in your agencies, many of the or at least one agency, one large agency, might even be my credit union, the folks who deal with the two different sides of the transactions are sitting right next to each other and maybe talking, and it sounds like you wouldn't object to their talking. So would you have any objection then to our writing into law the fact that we want them to be communicating?
Madam Chair, members, I think I'd have to take a look at the statistics. I mean, I think obviously it is happening in practice right now. The tough piece is once, well, at least from what I've heard. So I think the tough piece is once we start writing, scripting things into law, it gives, frankly, less flexibility in some cases to the financial institutions as to what they can do. So, and it just kind of adds in those additional requirements.
Let me just clarify. Are you testifying that they do now communicate with each other, that's your evidence that they do communicate with each other?
Madam Chair and members, I guess I use that as an anecdote.
All right.
From what I've heard from my members is that, you know, there definitely is communication. I think, you know, there is, to some degree, scope of size. I'm not saying large lenders can't communicate, but, mm-hmm. you know, in general, when you're talking about, you know, credit unions, they're not that big. It's not going to get missed. Mm-hmm. In terms of one hand not knowing what the other hand is doing.
Sure. And I think the point we've heard from our testifiers is that's the homeowner that really needs to be the one who is the final recipient of that information, even if they do talk with each other. Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam
Any
Chair.
Any further questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Can you speak to whether the credit unions, and maybe they missed this, but can you speak to whether or not they do dual tracking, and if so, if it's put into law that it's banned, how would that affect the credit unions?
Madam Chair and members, you know, right now I think that there could be cases where they could be doing something that would resemble or fall under this definition of dual tracking. As I said, most of my members that I talked to, and I haven't had a lot of chance to really run this by them, they really try to work out, before they end up in the foreclosure situation, before they start moving ahead. I think in some cases where they end up with someone who may be trying to drag their feet, they will continue doing it. If it looks like there's a resolution, they're going to absolutely postpone the sheriff's sale. But sometimes they do continue both, you know, as a way to either put pressure on or to just keep the process going. Unfortunately, I mean, in Minnesota, the timeline is, you know, minimum of 18 months, and it's been, you know, at least 2 years. So there are times when it doesn't make sense to stop the foreclosure process.
Representative O'Neill?
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. So you're saying that it depends on what the homeowner's actions are, and you, if this was written into law, that would limit your ability to move forward to reclaim that property if that homeowner is taking no action and not turning in paperwork and mm-hmm. you know, not working with you. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, that is correct. And I think we're looking at, the legislation says 60 days. So we're looking at, you know, a minimum of adding on 60 days to that piece. And I'm not sure where the 60 days comes from. It's my understanding from my credit unions, it would not take 60 days to talk to the department, talk and see if they can do a rework or a rewrite. So our concern is that it could be a delay tactic to just add on additional time.
Thank you. You're finished? Representative O'Neill. Okay, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Humphrey, I think, I don't know a lot about banks and others, credit unions, but I would say that credit unions are really unique in the relationships that you have with your members. In comparison to a U.S. bank or a Wells Fargo, you know, union credit unions are really unique in that relationship piece. So the testimony that I heard today from both our testifiers is that in their process of a realization that they could no longer keep up with their mortgage payment is that they wanted to do some kind of debt consolidation or modification. In both instances, I heard them say that the bank said to them that you need to go into default first in order to proceed. So I have two questions. One is that like common practice to say to a lender that you need to go into debt into default first? And is the dual tracking common practice?
Sumphrey.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, I can only comment from the credit union side in terms of what I've heard. And I think, first of all, to address the dual tracking, from what I've heard, that is not common practice. I mean, I think from the definitions that I've used in terms of how dual practice or dual tracking is used, by the time a credit union has reached that point, we've tried every available option. We've tried to reach out and do a workout. So from my understanding, that is not. The first question that you had, Representative Moran, was dealing with doing a workout. And from the credit unions that I've talked to, from what I've heard is, no, we absolutely want to, you know, avoid having them go into default if that's possible. So trying to do the workout on the front end before they end up defaulting is definitely the preferred option. And from what I've heard is our credit union members are reaching out to their members who may be looking like they default quite proactively, to the point that they're not missing out on the calls that they're getting because the credit union wants to try to address it on the front end.
Thank you.
And again, I just want to say credit unions are unique in that relationship with members. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran.
Thank you. Let's see. Well, I'm going to take Representative Mensa since you haven't had a chance. We'll come back to you, Representative Hertel. Representative Mensa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick question. Do you think that it would help, based on, I know the testimony before, one of the testifiers said that there was a 13-year window that they had been in their home. Do you think that adding, you know, the amount of time and structured payoff that they had completed would affect how that mortgage should or shouldn't be handled in a restructure?
Something.
Madam Chair, Representative Metza, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure. There's a reason why they put me on the lobbying piece and not on the mortgage lending side. I think definitely, I know that is one of the options that they look at if they're looking at doing a possible refinance, is adding that time on to the back. If there's an ability to do that, stretching out the time payment is one of the things that they look at, and that's something that is pretty common.
Thank you. So.
Thank you. Representative Hertel.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Moran, the question you asked regarding having to go into default, part of my understanding is part of the Frank Dodd legislation and authorizing restructuring of some of this debt really only applied to people who were in default. So oftentimes when you hear those things from people on the banking side advising a customer what they can or cannot do, they're advising them that the law doesn't permit them to go there in a conforming loan situation unless they're in default. It really defies logical sense that people should be encouraged to go into default in order to, you know, go to those negotiations. But that was something really part of my understanding as part of the federal legislation. It's tragic that we're having to talk about foreclosures and about modifications of foreclosure law. We really are talking about an underlying situation here with regard to jobs and the economy. In each of these cases, we've seen that individual circumstances have arisen in foreclosure as a result of diminished or reduced income to service that debt. Thank you.
Members of Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to respond to that and just quickly say that I can understand the federal law saying in order to get support, you need to go into default, and that is okay. The shameful part is to do the door tracking and for that person to think that you are working with them at the same time you're taking that property into foreclosure. That's the piece. That's a little bit sad.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hertel?
Representative Moran, I, in having worked with lenders on behalf of residential customers, find that in most circumstances, foreclosure is really the last resort. And lenders want to do workouts and to do as much as they can, but oftentimes they find themselves, according to the loan documents and according to the covenants, sometimes, not always, but sometimes restricted and are limited in what they can do and what they can offer. It really gets down to the issue of whether or not the candidate really is in a position to even do a modification or even is going to be able to do any type of redemption. And so that's oftentimes, you know, why the foreclosure process, you know, comes about.
Madam Chair, and maybe you could help me with this answer. So is dual tracking a common practice?
Well,
in my terms, you want to provide some testimony for the banks?
Thank you. You know, my experience has been that dual tracking usually is a tool in a number of toolkits that really keeps the negotiations and keeps the integrity of serious discussions going. Not all the time, particularly when we've created a market where mortgage-backed securities are sold off in the second market. One of the most effective tools to stop a mortgage foreclosure is simply to say three words, show me the note, or four words, I guess, because nobody knows where the original mortgage document is. They've been sold off and sold off and sold off, and this complicates the problem when oftentimes somebody who finds himself in a difficult situation is having to talk to numerous different individuals and being told a consortium of different things. Obviously, anybody who finds themselves in serious jeopardy of losing their home should seek competent legal advice right away.
Okay. Representative Bly.
Not comment or ask. You know, some of the issues, I think, for homeowners who find themselves in this situation is they want to trust their banker. And that's not to say that there aren't good bankers out there who give good information and negotiate with them in good faith. But what we've experienced in our economy is, in some ways, kind of predatory practices that have led us to this economic downturn that we're in. And I think the trust level has really eroded on the one hand. But on the other hand, you wonder, where is the fairness that we've bailed out banks, we've made sure that they're whole, and yet there are homeowners who can't find the same kind of treatment, can't find the same kind of protections. And some of it has to do with the fact of, you know, doing away with regulations that had been in place and no longer are in place, and they're you know, trying to find some way of making them work again. But we as legislators want to make sure that there are fair systems out there at work, and that I guess I find it ironic that the banks that led us down this path in some respect can't, you know, find ways to work with people. It's very frustrating.
All right. Well, I think your comment was appreciated, as we were hearing. Feel free to let others know, audience members, but we are going to have a chance for some of you to speak. If we get done here in time, I'm not sure. I did want to just share one piece of information that came to me, and it's maybe in regard to the point that was raised by Representative O'Neill. Rose McGee, who's not here, her bank was Citibank. It was not U.S. Bank, just so that you know when it... Oh, and I guess the other person who could not come was ill. Hers was Wells Fargo. So we don't have any cherry picking here. That's what you should know, though, about the people who did testify and who wanted to testify. Representative Bly, did you have a comment?
I'm not sure if you're finished with people who are testifying or not. But
I think we just about are. Did you want to wrap up with any of your? We're going to hear from the banking folks in just a moment. But in fact, let's hear from you first. We'll take the banking testimony, and then we'll let you wind up with the testimony. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, Representative Isaacson, after Representative Bly. Okay, dope.
I just wanted to kind of reiterate some of the comments that have been made about this being a statewide issue. And if you would pass out I too, when I was door knocking, ran across many homes that were foreclosed, and it was obvious that was what had caused the vacancy there. And I also, when I was serving the legislature before, would receive calls from people who were going through this process, and they and this is outstate Minnesota, where they had, you know, called their bank and tried to negotiate something, and every time they called the bank, they would find they were referred to a new person to deal with there. Many times they'd have to fax or send in all of the new information, all the information that they'd sent before. It was not being followed well, and their experience was a very difficult process. You know, they were very stressed by the fact that they might lose their home, and so it is something just kind of reiterate what you were saying about that. But this map talks about how it tracks the foreclosures from 2007 to 2011. I apologize for not having it in color. I do have some color copies of the map, and I can certainly email you a copy of it that would be in color. But I thought it was an interesting look at what happened with foreclosures across the state. The areas that I represented before and that I represent now fall into that category of the higher level of foreclosures. So it is something that affects many of us here and our constituents, and something that we ought to be aware of. And I hope that we'll all, you know, work together to try to find a process that is fair and equal. You also have a.
I want to make sure we have time for our testifier from Minnesota.
Madam
Banking Association. But is it on this question, on this document?
I just mentioned to Representative Bly that I also sought out some information and brought color copies.
Oh, good.
So they're being distributed right now.
Great.
Thank you.
It's not the same piece, but it's a little bit easier to read.
Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate our committee members taking some initiative here. That's great. Representative Isaacson, is it something you want to do now, or can you?
I will pass until the end.
All right. Let's. Thank you so much, Ms. Humphries. And let's hear from Tess Rice from the Minnesota Bankers Association, please. Welcome to the committee, and if you introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. I'm Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The Minnesota Bankers Association's trade association, and we represent about 94% of the banks in Minnesota. That's about 400 banks, from the very largest to the very smallest. We saw this language for the first time on Monday, and so we haven't had time to get enough feedback from our members to be very specific with our comments today, but we do look forward to working with Representative Freiberg and the committee on the bill. We have some general comments. Just a reminder that we've passed 28 foreclosure bills in the last 5 years or so with 70 different provisions, and the vast majority of those provisions were agreed to and worked out among all the stakeholders. So we're proud of that we didn't oppose any of those. We worked hard with the groups and came up with what we think is a pretty consumer-friendly foreclosure language in Minnesota. In addition to our laws in Minnesota, there's been a lot of federal action. There are at least 12 federal rules that are in process right now from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and other federal agencies. And we expect to see rules as early as, well, it could be this week or next week, from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that address much of what is in this bill. It will definitely address dual tracking, and it will address a single point of contact. So we will be sure to get back with Representative Freiberg after that comes out and let him see what the federal law is doing. But I imagine it's going to be very similar to what is in this bill. And we, in our way, we prefer federal language because when a bank chooses to lend in Minnesota, a lot of these banks that we're talking about aren't Minnesota banks. They choose to lend in Minnesota because it's a good place to lend. The more we increase the risk to lend in Minnesota, the more expensive it is to foreclose. The more risk there is lending here, the more expensive it is for every Minnesotan to borrow money here. So there's a lot of moving parts with this bill. We've got the existing state law. We have to think about how the different provisions of these bills will work with that and work with each other. There's the National Mortgage Settlement from the Attorney General's office that there's five of the largest servicers are under right now that address dual tracking and have a single point of contact. Mm-hmm. Our Attorney General, Lori Swanson, was part of that agreement. And then we do have those pending regulations from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau coming down the road. So we appreciate the opportunity to work with Representative Freiberg and all the other interested stakeholders on this language. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. Questions from committee members? But maybe I'll ask one. I don't see any hands. I think the question's been asked by several people about whether or not dual tracking was a common practice of our banks in Minnesota. Can you respond to that, please?
Well, I don't know if it was a common practice, but I do believe that it is no longer a practice that is common. The National Mortgage Settlement addresses about 60% of the loans that are made in Minnesota. That prohibits dual tracking, and I believe that other banks have adopted those guidelines as well, and so it is not a typical practice anymore.
Okay, and can you say when that ended? Your understanding of is when that dual tracking would have ended?
I think the national mortgage settlement was in October of 2012.
Okay, so to your knowledge, since that's been enacted and settled, there's dual tracking is not continuing with our... Is this federally chartered banks, or are you talking about all banks in Minnesota?
The national settlement, if it is in October, it may actually be a year old. I've got a lot of dates in my head, but that addressed five major banks, and that was 60% of the market. Okay. The rules that will come from the CFPB will apply to all lenders.
Okay. And those rules are forthcoming?
Yes, we expect them this week or next week.
Okay. Representative Metza, need your hand up.
So I guess the way I'm interpreting that answer is unless we regulate some of this, you would continue those practices, and if as legislators we weren't looking at issues like this, that it would be commonplace?
Madam Speaker, Representative Metza, not sure I totally understand your question, but I can tell you that practices have changed, and I'm sure that the AG settlement was a big part of that.
Thank you, Chairwoman. Which five banks would that be in the settlement?
Madam Chair, Representative. I know it's GMAC and Wells Fargo. I can't recall it, who the other three are. No other Minnesota banks are in it.
So if I'm understanding, those are the only banks that will be affected by that.
Madam Chair, those are the only banks as part of the national settlement, mm-hmm. but all banks will, I think, end up with about the same rules from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Okay, so it's from another, the other source. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Madam Chair, it's Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and GMAC.
Thank you.
I could say it faster if you'd like me to. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and GMAC.
Okay. Any
and
further?
Being new to this process, I'm interested in understanding one part about dual tracking that I'm not sure I think has been kind of fleshed out, but just so I can understand the purpose of it, is the idea, and I think it's been insinuated, this is the idea that keeping the foreclosure process going while working with someone who's trying to fix it motivates them theoretically to stay focused on that. Is that what the purpose of dual tracking is?
That's nice.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson,
I didn't mean that to be a leading question. I'm literally asking that question because I don't know and I can't understand the purpose of why it would exist. So I'm just wondering, is that, in theory, maybe harshly put, the point? Or
you know, Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, I've only spoke to our community bank members mm-hmm. about this. I haven't spoke to any of the larger members about why dual tracking exists for them. Okay. I talked to a community bank out in rural Minnesota, and I assumed that he would not mind this bill. And he said to me, if people are serious about doing a modification, that's not a problem. But if they are using this to delay, if they use a modification to delay, so they say I want a modification, and then they don't provide the documents, mm-hmm. I need to have that tool in the background. Again, this is a community bank, and...
So it would be interesting... I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. It would be interesting to know, especially like with that particular banker, what the percentages of times people are actually stalling for the sake of stalling versus when it's actually a relevant tool. I think that'd be something that would be interesting to know in terms of how important that practice is for them.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, I think, happily for you all, it will be a moot point. The CFPB will prohibit dual tracking, and so...
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Isaacson, okay. So, thank you. Are there any other questions for this witness?
Okay. I have...
Representative Isaacson.
And so, your settlement you spoke of was... you said you think October of 2012, possibly the year before, you weren't sure, right? Is that right? Okay, I'm just making sure. So, and my understanding is that, and my understanding is that Rose was dual track this year. Is that correct? So, my question would be then is going back to the point that I clearly understood from Representative Metza, was unless something's actually done about it, it's really just a protocol, not not actually something that can be enforced, or there isn't an oversight from someone that can manage that. In terms of self-regulation.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, to clarify the dates on that, the date of that settlement was April 2012. The dual tracking prohibition was applicable on October 3rd, 2012.
Thank you.
They are held accountable under the AG settlement. They have, those banks do have to report. They're telling me it is, I think, quarterly when they have to file reports on this and get things audited to make sure that they are following these rules.
Thank you so much. That clarifies it. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions or comments? Okay, committee members, I do want to remind you this is our first hearing on this bill, and so we heard a number of questions that we didn't get answered today, or there were partial answers. We'll be able to come back and we'll ask the members here to do that. I for one, want to hear a little bit more about our relationship with Freddie Mac. That seemed to be one of the other bodies that was having has a relationship here to a lot of our Minnesotans. So I think with that, you can be excused, Ms. Rice. I appreciate that. I did say there might be time for another witness, and I think we can do one if you're okay with that. Representative Freiberg, I'll give you a moment to wrap up. But there's a veteran here who'd like to speak to the veterans part of the bill, and that's Mr. Drews, I believe. Mr. Doug Drews, is he here?
Can everybody hear me?
Can you sit down at the seat and introduce? Okay, that's okay.
Everybody hear me? This is unbelievable. Can you imagine what active duty people are going through?
Excuse me, can you just introduce yourself for that?
Can you imagine what active duty people are going through over in Iraq and Afghanistan when they get a foreclosure notice and somebody like me?
Madam Chair, point of, can you just say your name?
Douglas Drews.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I bought my first house on the GI Bill in 1973. My wife and I, my ex-wife and I, bought, remodeled, and sold four homes in 7 years, and then bought property, and then I built a house. It took me 3 years to build it. And 3 years ago, Agent Orange has gotten me, so I can't continue to run my business that I built up since 1975. And all the crap that could be settled with all the communications with this, with a simple document. It's called a certified letter. If the banks in all this stuff would just send the borrowers certified letters, everyone would have a document stating when that was picked up. The people could call them. They need a single. In the bill here, it's great. You've got a single contact point that does not exist right now at all. And everything in this bill is good. Everyone needs more time. The only thing that's not in this bill is the law requiring that, especially for military personnel and retired and veterans, is that it doesn't require them to renegotiate the interest rate. What we're talking about here, you could probably paper this room with foreclosures that could have been solved by dropping an interest rate by 2 points. So it's just, excuse me, pass the damn bill, and the rest of it's a waste of time. Thank you.
Mr. Drews, just hold on a second. We want to see if there's any questions from committee members. Questions, committee members, from Mr. Drews? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh, excuse me, Representative Mr. Drews, excuse me. Is it for him?
More of a statement. I just
Representative Metza.
Publicly state our appreciation, and thank you, Madam Chair. Publicly state our appreciation for his service.
Okay. Mr. Drews, I hope you
second that.
Okay.
There's an old saying from World War II vets.
Mr. Drews?
That's about equal to what the Purple Heart and a dime will get you, a cup of coffee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drews. Okay, Representative Freiberg, your last word on your bill here. We're going to be adjourning in a few minutes.
Sure. As I said, I think these are common sense provisions. I don't see really a business necessity for a procedure like dual tracking or not having a single point of contact. I'm certainly willing to hear from both credit unions and the banks their suggestions as to ways they feel this could be improved. As I said, see what they have to say. I had more, but maybe I'll just leave it at that. So
you have time. Maybe you've got a couple minutes if you want to say anything more.
I'm not.
Okay.
It went out of my head.
All right. Okay, then go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I do remember. I did Representative Mariani's point, you know, that we're legislating here based on broad policy and not focusing on litigation. I thought that was a good point. So, you know, the settlement that was discussed is only applicable to the people who were parties to the settlement. So I think, you know, we're looking at the bigger picture here. If the federal rule does come out prohibiting dual tracking, I think that'd be great. I think there are other provisions in here I'd still like to see. Just the pace of change at the federal government level is kind of slow, so I'm a little worried about holding it up. But I do look forward to discussing this again in this committee, and thank you for considering.
Thank you. And what I found with this wonderful new legislator here is that he's very willing to meet with anyone who wants to meet with him. So I would just encourage you all to communicate with him before our next meeting on this bill, which will probably be won't be next week, but maybe the following week. I think it's Urban Zerbas. Did I understand you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question. Reading through this, the one part that, as I read through, doesn't make a lot of sense to me is the mandatory mediation that is required that the lender pays for it. It's mandatory if requested by the borrower, and it isn't binding anyway. So I'm wondering, other than getting the two people and two parties in the same place to talk, I'm wondering kind of what the point of that kind of in this legislation is.
Sure. Well, I mean,
is
it's... I'm sorry. I'm still getting used to that as well, so it's not just the people speaking. It's a form, you know, mediation is a form of alternative dispute resolution. It's less adversarial than being in a courtroom or an eviction hearing. It's something I think that has the potential to take some of the charge out of it, make it less personal, having a neutral third party involved. So,
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Zervas.
It may be less adversarial if you're not being the one being forced to pay for it. I think it becomes a little bit more adversarial there. I mean, I think there's some of the stuff makes sense, and it sounds like a lot of it through other action is coming down the pike. The mandatory mediation to me just doesn't fit in and doesn't make sense.
Sure.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, you know, when you sign a contract, many contracts have provisions for binding arbitration. Both mediation and arbitration are forms of alternative dispute resolution. We're still working out, you know, the details. I'm willing, you know, certainly willing to look at this again to hear what you and other stakeholders feel about this provision. I think it makes sense, but see what people think, I guess, as this process moves forward.
Okay, I have three people who now want to speak. Representative Hertas, O'Neill, and Metza. So, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to echo the comments made by Representative Mariani as well, that, you know, we need to approach this and look at the broad policy, and that it benefits not just a select group of individuals, but Minnesotans in all. On a point of order, just a question with regard to the initial draft language in your bill. I was wondering if it was your intention with regards to the references to veterans, was it your intention that you meant active duty veterans who were away and maybe didn't have that point of contact or offer them protection from foreclosure while they're doing service to our country, or were you doing it a broad sweep that veterans in particular would have a separate set of privilege under this bill?
I'd be interested in it being as broad as possible, both active duty service members and veterans.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I have two questions. So, for the record, would you be, you talked about working with the shareholders and so on, would you consider having the homeowner and the bank co-pay, you know, pay equally or at least have some skin in the game in order to move forward with mediation?
I don't know that I'm prepared to.
Representative Freiberg.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Don't know that I'm prepared to agree to that. I mean, I'd like to think about it a little more. I mean, many of the people who find themselves in this situation obviously are in financial distress. So, imposing costs on them, I would be wary of.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
And you had mentioned that if the federal provisions come forward, there are still pieces in this bill that would not be in the federal provisions, but the dual tracking and the single point of contact would be. That I, as I'm hearing the testimony, can we just get clarification as to what all the federal points were and how your bill is different?
Representative O'Neill, I just have a suggestion here, which is because we're just about out of time, and what I'm suggesting is maybe that you carry on this conversation again. I think the author is very willing to have that conversation with you and any other members, and we probably need to get a little more information before the full committee on what the federal provisions are. And I think we'll make sure we have a hearing as part of that, maybe even before we have the next bill, has a bill back. But I think it's a legitimate question. Representative Freiberg.
I was just going to say, from what I understand, you know, from what I understand, we don't know what's in there yet.
That's not, so that's right.
It would be a short answer.
Wait, no. So. Okay, Representative Metzler, you have the final word.
I will withdraw that for right now. Thank you, Madam Chair, and let us get on.
I will take it and say that the bill is laid over and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members. Thank you.